You're listening to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Over the past couple of years, we've heard complaints that social media is making it too easy to encase ourselves in bubbles of like-mindedness, and that these echo chambers we create are fueling increasing political polarization. We've been told that we should seek out differing opinions, and that social media should be redesigned to present us with a diversity of views. Well, now new research says that maybe that's not exactly the right way to go about things, that in fact, exposure to opposing views on social media can actually exacerbate political polarization. Chris Bale is the Douglas and Ellen Lowy Associate Professor of Sociology and Public Policy at Duke University and the lead author on that new study. Chris, welcome to Living Lab Radio.
Thanks so much for having me.
Is this good news or bad news? I mean, is this our excuse to all go crawl back into our comfy little bubble, or what should we be taking away from this study?
No, I don't think we should be crawling back into our bubbles just yet. This is the first in what will hopefully be many studies of how social media shapes our political views. And, our study was really just limited to Twitter users, and only about 25% of Americans use Twitter. And at that, Twitter users who are politically identified, who prefer either the Republican or Democratic Party, and that means even a smaller segment of Twitter.
Before we get into how you actually did this study, you just said this is the first of hopefully many studies about how social media affects our political views. How can this be the first study of that when it's clearly such an important factor in our lives at this point?
Sure. So there have been many studies, in fact, that look at how the patterns of who we friend or follow on social media are associated with our political views. But these kind of observational studies present a kind of chicken and the egg problem. Is it the case that social media shapes our political views, or is it the case that our political views shape who we friend and follow on social media? And in order to disentangle that, one needs to do a randomized experiment. And so ours, as far as we know, was one of the first studies, if not the first study, to experimentally disrupt people's social media echo chambers.
And how did you do this test? How did you test the effect of what people see on Twitter and how that affects their political views?
Sure. We surveyed about 1,200 Democrats and Republicans who use Twitter regularly in October of 2017. And we asked half of them if they would be willing to receive financial compensation for following bots that our research team built that were designed to expose them to opposing views. We didn't tell them what the bots were going to do, but they agreed to follow the bots for 1 month and understood that the bots would tweet 24 times a day. What they didn't know was that the bots would be exposing them to messages from elected officials, opinion leaders, media personalities, and so on, from the opposing political party.
So you're asking people to add this kind of automated Twitter persona, the bot, not actually a person, that's giving them opposing views. But why wouldn't they just consent to do that? Why did you feel you needed to pay them to do that?
Well, for a few reasons, I guess. One is, I think all research subjects should be compensated for their time in principle, but also because, in the era of social media research, such as the fiasco with Cambridge Analytica, we've seen a lot of cases where people's private data have been abused. And so it was very important to my team to do this in an ethical way and to do this in a fair way. And so we worked with a reputable survey firm to identify people who were willing to participate.
So let's go back to those bots, those kind of automated retweeting machines, essentially, that you were having people follow. What kind of content were you feeding to these?
Sure. So we didn't drive that decision. We simply selected the accounts that the bot would randomly draw from. So the bots drew from all elected officials in the U.S., and then all people who are followed by at least 15 elected officials. So this broader sample included organizations like, NPR or Fox News or the Heritage Foundation and other kind of civil society groups. The goal was to expose people to the full range of messages from the other side.
And then how do you measure the impact of that exposure?
So our initial survey asked people a series of 10 questions about their views on social policies, things like climate change, government regulation of the economy, whether racial discrimination is responsible for the poverty of African Americans. And then we asked everyone in the study the same 10 questions at the conclusion of the study, 1 month after the treatment group followed the bots. And then what we measured was how much each group in treatment and control changed.
And what kinds of effects did you see?
So we had a few ideas going in. One of them was that, and your lead-in kind of alluded to this, is that if you expose people to opposing views, it might increase moderation because people become kind of more aware of the other side. Stereotypes they may have had about how the other type thinks or acts may be kind of contradicted by experience. And for neither Republicans nor Democrats did we see a decrease in political polarization. For Democrats, we saw a very small increase in liberal views, but this effect wasn't statistically significant. On the other hand, for Republicans, we saw a very large increase in conservative views.
Wow. So how do you explain that difference? Why would Democrats and Republicans be differently affected by seeing differing or opposing views on Twitter?
Sure. So one explanation comes from cultural sociology and social psychology, which are my fields. And, research tradition has shown that liberals and conservatives simply hold different value systems. A central tenet of the conservative worldview is tradition, and inherent in that is resisting change. And conversely, the liberal worldview embraces diversity and indeed stresses, reaching out and actively engaging with other ideas. That's one idea. Another explanation is that people are taking cues from political leaders. So if we look at patterns in the way that elected officials in the U.S. have voted over the last 20, 30 years, we see a marked shift to the right among conservatives, taking increasingly conservative positions in voting, and a very slight movement to the left among liberal elected officials.
Could there be something about the nature of the content? As you said, you weren't creating it or necessarily even curating the content that people saw. And while this idea that, being exposed to other views and people with differing views could create more empathy and help us find common ground, that's not necessarily what a lot of content on social media and Twitter in particular is designed to do. It's maybe kind of designed to reinforce people's beliefs or to, sting the opposite side. Could that maybe account for some of what you're seeing in terms of actually increasing polarization?
So we did take careful steps to compare the language of the Republican and Democratic bots using tools from a field called natural language processing, which uses automated analysis of text to look for different patterns. We didn't see any suspicious patterns in terms of, the level of extremity of the views. For example, many people have wondered whether our Democrats were being exposed to more extreme ideology than the Republicans were. We didn't see evidence of that. At the same time, I don't think, your audience should take away from our study that all attempts to kind of reach across the partisan divide are inherently flawed. Certainly, as you, I think we're just suggesting, Twitter does not, afford the kind of forum for rational debate, the kind of genuine competition of ideas that so many of us might like to see. Instead, I think you're quite right that there's an awful lot of cheerleading going on.
So maybe this is kind of, I don't want to say a special case, because we are spending, for the most part, a lot of time on social media. But social media may not be acting the same way that, say, real-world conversations or real-world interactions would. That maybe if we encounter somebody with differing views on the street and we have a conversation, that could have a moderating impact. Whereas if we encountered that same person's views in 140 characters on Twitter, that might not have the same effect. Is that kind of what you take away from this?
Exactly. We have decades of research in social psychology that suggests that intimate interpersonal contact between members of an in-group and an out-group or any two members of rival groups can reduce prejudice. And that's because we think that kind of personal experience can provide people with evidence that contradicts the stereotypes that might grow in the absence of such intergroup contact. The important question is, can that be created on social media? And, at the present moment, I think it's easy to take a cynical view. On the other hand, as you suggested, social media isn't going away. If we look at the rates of social media usage among younger people, especially, and particularly how many younger people are turning to social media to get their news and to discuss politics. I think there's no scenario where we can simply move all our political conversation offline and fix the problem. I think instead we have to look for new solutions online. And that's what we've been trying to do at the Duke Polarization Lab that I founded this year.
I just want to go back to this idea. I mean, Twitter has become so important, so central in politics at this point. It's the way that our president breaks news. It's the way that a lot of our news organizations find news. If Twitter is having this polarizing effect, and it can spill over into real life. I mean, if somebody's getting more polarized on Twitter and then starts having real life interactions, you know, that's going to spill over potentially. Is Twitter bad for politics, bad for our society at this point?
Well, I mean, certainly if we look to other countries, we can see some even more horrifying developments. You know, for example, a recent news article I read suggested that there's been over a dozen lynchings related to misinformation that was spread on WhatsApp, the popular messaging platform, and I believe it was India. So, you know, I don't think we are quite at that state. I think, you know, many Americans are able to differentiate between what happens online and what happens offline. But I think in the context of what's been called the big sort, or the increasing correlation between geography and our political preferences, that is, liberals are all living in one part of the country and conservatives are largely living in another, you know, we may not have much other choice than to develop some type of digital solution to find compromise.
Does this research point us in that direction? I mean, that's basically the final sentence of the study you published as well, saying that future research is going to need to start figuring out what types of messages, what tactics, what issues are suitable and effective for discussing on social media. Does this give us any directions, at least to start in that research?
Yeah. In fact, a study that came out a week after ours, a very interesting study led by Damon Santola at the University of Pennsylvania, put Democrats and Republicans together in a kind of online game. And his team asked them to predict the amount of climate change that might occur according to historical data. And so there was a right answer and a wrong answer about the forecast. And he had them deliberate in two types of settings. In one of the settings, the Democrats and Republicans were labeled as such. People knew each other's political preferences. And in the other condition, they did not. And what his team found is that when people are aware of those political preferences, when those identities are put before the ideas, that they see the same effect we saw, a kind of backfire effect. People become more entrenched in their pre-existing views and provide less accurate guesses about the extent of climate change. But when you take away those party labels, his team finds that there's actually a slight decrease in polarization around this issue. And so maybe that's one clue about how to move forward.
In the meantime, as you and others are studying this and trying to figure out better tactics for using and being on social media, do you have any recommendations for those of us who are on social media right now, how to change our behavior? Do we disengage? What's the short-term strategy to try to limit some of these harmful effects?
Sure. I think one of the first implications of our study is that there's going to be no easy solution. You know, we can't just simply pop the filter bubbles or break the echo chambers and expect all the problems to go away. And I think partly that's because, you know, what we did is it creates kind of quite a shock to someone's worldview. You know, you imagine you're used to reading NPR, the New York Times, the Washington Post, and all of a sudden you're encountered with Breitbart or other very unfamiliar messages. They're, you know, not only talking about the issues you know of in different ways, but talking about altogether different issues. And, you know, the idea that we can, you know, quickly change Republicans into Democrats or vice versa, I think is of course very naive, right, at the present political juncture. So instead of doing these kind of all-encompassing shifts, I think a better way to proceed would be a piecemeal approach that kind of looks at one of the few remaining issues where there is the opportunity for bipartisan compromise, something like developing market-based solutions for climate change. You know, there, if we can get people talking together, and particularly if we can get them talking without queuing their partisan identities, if we can have people put their ideas before their identities, I think we may be able to move the needle at the periphery And then maybe that's a first step towards a more global reduction in polarization.
Take it slow and stop broadcasting your political identity.
Exactly. You know, there's very little to be gained by name calling or feeling right on social media at this point. And some people have even made that a hobby, I think, without recognizing what a negative impact it might have. You know, many of us, when we go on social media, we quickly encounter views that are diametrically opposed to our own. And it may well be that the people espousing those views are extreme members of the other party, because we know that the people talking about politics on social media sites are disproportionately ideologues. And so if it's the case that, you know, I see someone like that, I may misunderstand that person as representative of the other side. And that creates a kind of fundamental disconnect and can harden stereotypes and increase apathy and so on and so forth. So I think if we can get more moderate voices online, too, that might help.
Christopher Bale is the Douglas and Ellen Lowy Associate Professor of Sociology and Public Policy at Duke University. Chris, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Up next, explaining quantum physics with heavy metal. Stay with us.